This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What happens when a black father tries to do his young daughter's natural hair for the first time? In the animated short Hair Love, a battle ensues. The father wields a comb as his weapon, but his first attempt is a miserable failure. With his daughter's encouragement and the help of a guided video, he eventually succeeds. The charming 7-minute film won the Oscar for Best Animated Short.
There were so many filmmakers that worked so hard on this, and it was a labor of love. And it was because we have a firm belief that representation matters deeply. Especially in cartoons. Because in cartoons, that's when we first see our movies, and it's how we shape our lives and think about how we see the world.
That's producer Karen Rupert Tolliver. She was joined on stage by creator Matthew Cherry, who dedicated the award to Kobe Bryant. The intersection of the two popular culture stories is one of our many topics on this month's installment of Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll talk with Emmy Award-winning documentarian Stanley Nelson about his ESPN 30 for 30 on former NFL quarterback Michael Vick. Joining me for that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome to both of you. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
What's up, Frank?
Good to have you here. I want to start by talking about this short film, Hair Love, and actually we can start with a clip because there's a moment when the father and daughter are watching a video tutorial narrated by the mom.
Are you ready to do this? All right, here we go. First, you want to moisturize these beautiful thick curls with a leave-in conditioner, which will also help detangle the kinks. Now, part all your hair into sections, clip it away. You're doing an amazing job.
A little bit from Hair Love, a 7-minute animated short created by Michael Cherry, won the Oscar on Sunday for Best Animated Short. Talking about that with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So, Natalie, tell us more about this short. What sticks with you?
First of all, it's incredibly touching to see an animated, I mean, really anything about a young girl and her father doing her hair. And I love the treatment of her natural hair, which, you know, Matt Cherry doesn't make fun of it, but he deals with the fact that, you know, our natural hair in its natural state can be unwieldy, it can be challenging, and that we often don't know what to do with it, and especially in our society where moms are typically the ones who are tasked with doing the kids' hair. To see this dad really struggle and then settle into like a comfort with doing his daughter's hair, I love the representation. I mean, and as the producer, Karen Rupert Tolliver, says, it's everything. You know, we don't see that. And she's absolutely right when she talks about how cartoons is where we begin to form our ideas about the world. So to see something like this that can appeal to both kids and adults, I think is wonderful.
Mark?
You know, the film disrupts a lot of assumptions that we have about black folks, obviously, fathers, black fathers. You know, Matthew Cherry's a former professional football player, right? So, you know, we wouldn't think of a football player within that kind of context. The film itself, you know, it started as a Kickstarter campaign, right? We always think about them as vanity projects, right? But this is something that's doing so much more. And as a father of two daughters who has stories, particularly with my oldest daughter who has the thick hair.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, video, there's a representation. There's a photo of the day that I had to do the hair for the pictures, you know, at JCPenney that we always go back to. So, oh, that's the day that your dad tried to do your hair. But underlying this kind of moment is celebratory. We realize that the mom is not there for a reason, right? And so it does this additional work of saying, yes, your hair is important, but your hair isn't everything. Yeah. When you see the little girl do this picture, hand-drawn picture of her mother and her bald head and just the crown. And with all the moment that's happening now with Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman from Massachusetts, it's just a powerful statement about the importance of image and representation and how hair is just only a small part of it and not everything at the same time.
Yeah. And so much culturally available. As you said, just in telling your story, Mark, this could have been a 50s sitcom in terms of the conceit, right?
Absolutely.
And then so many cultural layers, masculinity, hair, black hair, women's hair. I mean, it's just an incredible amount gets packed into 7 minutes of a cartoon. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just wanted to add that, you know, one of the things that endears me to Hair Love is I remember being that little girl with a ton of hair and my mom even not knowing what to do with it and the things that she went through to try and tame it, you know. And even though there is so much made of black natural hair in negative ways, you know, this is an affirmation of how beautiful, if not strong and unwieldy, our hair is, but that, you know, there's so much beauty in its natural state and that we need to embrace it.
And have it represented. Yeah, two producers of the short were invited a Texas high school student, DeAndre Arnold, as their special guest of the Oscars. And he made national news last month when his high school suspended him and told him he couldn't walk at graduation on the grounds that his dreadlocks were too long. So there's a story that has many themes in the headlines. Let's listen to a clip of creator Michael Cherry now. He's, as you said, a former NFL player who directed, wrote, and produced the short film.
We really get a bad rap in mainstream media, particularly black fathers. You know, there's always the stereotype that, you know, we're not present or deadbeats, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And while obviously those situations do exist, it feels very much so that it's just like disproportionately represented in that way. And, you know, I have a lot of friends that are young fathers and they're all willing to do whatever it takes for their young girls. And, you know, this was just kind of me putting myself in their shoes and kind of representing and also really being inspired by all these viral videos of dads doing their daughter's hair and people just really being fascinated by that.
That's Matthew Cherry in a conversation with NPR's Michelle Martin, creator of the Oscar-winning animated short Hair Love. I'm talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel on The State of Things. Mark, talk about the representation of black fathers in this animation.
You know, Matthew said it so very well. It's, you know, there's an idea that black men are absent, that they're not present in their children's lives. And if they are present, it's in, you know, really simplistic ways in terms of being disciplinary figures or money earners. What we rarely see of black men is, in fact, this much more emotive side, this side of them that's tender. You know, it, even as he's fighting with the hair, right, in the context of it, you know, what you see are these moments of tenderness. And you have to imagine, given the story, that there are many of these moments that we don't get to see in this 7-minute clip because her mom is not there, right? And he has to be able to assure his daughter. And again, we don't see these kinds of images of black men on a regular basis. There's a way in which, yes, animation is the great place to start. But we need to see more of these images in reality, right, in real time, in the way that, you know, black men live their lives as fathers.
And it raises other questions, too, because Matthew Cherry became the second former athlete in 3 years to win an Oscar in this in the animated short category, following the footsteps of the late Kobe Bryant. And Cherry dedicated the award to Kobe, receiving the hashtag GirlDad. Let's talk about more about the intersection of these two stories. Kobe Bryant, again, kind of famous for his for being the father of three girls.
Four girls, because one daughter was just born in July. I mean, it's really interesting to me that these dads, these athletes, these former athletes are, you know, winning in terms of Oscars, but also that there is a way that they are both, they both have an awareness and a consciousness of what it means for a dad to have a meaningful relationship with their daughter or daughters. And, you know, I think it's really fitting that Matthew Cherry dedicated his Oscar to Kobe. You know, besides the fact that Kobe died with his daughter Gianna, I mean, the relationship that they had in terms of basketball, right? The the camaraderie and the love that they shared for that sport. And from all reports, Gianna was going to be, you know, someone to be reckoned with on the basketball court, or already is or was. And so I think there's an interesting way that, you know, these two men's lives and their focus and their desire to lift up these representations of girls, not just as, you know, not on the one hand, Matthew Cherry is showing this relationship with a father and his daughter in terms of her hair, right, which is girly. But then Kobe was, you know, he was lifting up his daughter as, you know, not only is she my daughter and she loves basketball, but I don't need to have a son to take over my legacy, right? And I think that's important.
We're going to talk more about Kobe's legacy after the break, but why don't we just listen to Kobe Bryant in a 2018 interview from the podcast, The School of Greatness.
I think the definition of greatness is to inspire the people next to you. I think that's what greatness is or should be. It's not something that lives and dies with one person. It's how can you inspire a person to then in turn inspire another person that then inspires another person. And that's how you create something that I think lasts forever. Yeah. And I think that's our challenge as people, is to figure out how our story can impact others and motivate them in a way to create their own greatness.
Late basketball legend Kobe Bryant in a 2018 interview. Talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. More on Kobe Bryant and much, much more on Back Channel as that continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Admirers around the country are still mourning the loss of Los Angeles Lakers legend Kobe Bryant. He died in a helicopter crash last month, along with his 13-year-old daughter and seven others. Murals are still popping up all around Los Angeles, and his death hung over the Grammys, the Oscars, and NBA games all across the country. But alongside these tributes, there was conversation and consternation about how a 2003 rape allegation against Kobe fits the picture. How do we pay tribute to someone's legacy in all of its complexity? Still with me to answer these questions and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Let's talk about the loss of Kobe Bryant. Mark Anthony Neal, when you heard, what was the impact? What did you first think?
You know, so I'm not a Kobe stan. You know, Kobe came into the league, he was a child. And didn't have the benefit of seeing him have a collegiate career to know who he was. So he was just this young guy who played basketball. But of course, you look at the arc of the career and what he achieved on the court, and then you looked at him as a grown man post his basketball career, and you could not help but take great pride in who he had become and how he had transformed himself. When I first heard the news, I thought of two men immediately, my best friend Sebastian and Ninth Wonder. And I thought about them in particular because they are fathers who have basketball-playing daughters, teenagers. And as the father of a swimmer, I know what that means to be on these travel teams. And if you're Kobe Bryant and you have the means, I absolutely understand why you would want, instead of spending 2.5 hours in traffic, you know, on I-10, to have the means to fly in helicopter so that you can be there for those dinners, be there for every practice, be there for every game and performance. And so in that regard, it was so heartbreaking because not only don't we see Black fathers, right? We don't see the extent that Black fathers will do what they can do in order to be there. When you go to these travel basketball games or baseball games or, you know, swimming, all I see is Black fathers, right? Black fathers that no one ever sees are sitting there for 10 hours, right? That might see their kids play for 25 minutes. And so to think that he died in the context of doing what we all feel we always need to do was heartbreaking.
Yeah, I really appreciate Mark's comments. My husband told me, and he kind of told me matter-of-factly, and I was like, you lying. What? I mean, it just did not register. I could not believe. It's not like I'm a huge fan, but there was something about Kobe, and it's similar to, you know, how I felt about Nipsey Hussle. I didn't know who Nipsey Hussle was until he died. But everything I learned about him in the wake of his death made me respect him so much. And same with Kobe. Kobe's just determination, his laser-like focus on greatness, on just being committed to pushing himself and moving forward, like, that's inspirational. So you can't help but feel, but mourn and grieve the loss of life, and certainly Gigi taken far too soon.
Yeah, and he talked about all of that, about being the father, and a lot about what you and Mark had both said about being the father of an athlete, also a big supporter of the WNBA, big part of his legacy. Let's listen to a clip of an interview he did with Jimmy Kimmel in 2018.
Do you think your daughter might want to play in the WNBA?
She does, for sure.
She does?
Like, I don't, I mean, this kid, man.
Wouldn't that be great?
Dude, man, I'm telling you. The best thing that happens is when we go out and fans will come up to me and she'll be standing next to me and they'll be like, hey, you got to have a boy. UNV got to have a boy, man. You got somebody carry on the tradition, the legacy. She's like, oi, I got this. You know, boy for that.
There we go. That's, of course, Kobe Bryant in 2018 with Jimmy Kimmel. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. But then questions come up about his legacy. The question was raised almost early, very shortly after his death, I think, starting with a tweet, and then sort of it becomes part of the zeitgeist, a 2003 rape allegation. And I want to start with the latest piece of the conversation, because that hits the internet. People are now talking about the fact that anybody had raised the question of this rape allegation. But then there's the latest piece of the conversation stems from a clip of CBS News interview that aired last week between Gayle King and WNBA star Lisa Leslie. So let's listen to the clip first.
Is it even a fair question to talk about it, considering he's no longer with us and that it was resolved? Or is it really part of his history?
I think that the media should be more respectful at this time. It's like, if you had questions about it, you've had many years to ask him that. I don't think it's something that we should keep hanging over his legacy. I mean, it went to trial.
Yeah, but the case was dismissed because the victim in the case refused to testify. So it was dismissed.
And I think that's how we should leave it.
So that's CBS host Gayle King talking with WNBA star Lisa Leslie in an interview last week. That CBS released the clip to promote a longer interview. The interview went for more than half an hour. But, man, there was social media backlash. Natalie, what do you make? Because, I mean, there were threats. I mean, the fact is that Gayle King was you know, receiving threats as a result of asking the question. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I have all kinds of feelings and thoughts. But what I will say is that, you know, Gayle King is a professional journalist. She did her job. If you listen to the entire interview, what she talks about and asks Lisa Leslie about in the context of the interview flows naturally. And I think that there's a way that our culture, and I think certainly I think the Black community does this. We want to, like, when someone passes away, we like to say all of the good things, and we don't want to bring up, we find it disrespectful to bring up anything that would taint the reputation of whoever has died. And I tend to think that, you know, we can be a little more nuanced than that. Something happened in 2003. However it got resolved, the fact of the matter is that happened. And although it is a part of his legacy, it does not define him. It is not who he is. And as Mark said earlier, we saw Kobe turn into this person in our culture as a father that tells us something about who he actually was. And I think we could look at someone like Harvey Weinstein and we could say there is a pattern. This has been going on for years. We could look at R. Kelly and say there is a pattern. And I'm not trying to excuse what Kobe did or was alleged to have done, or even, at, you know, by his own admission, he said, I apparently had a misunderstanding of what was going on. I thought it was consensual. She didn't. Okay, so period. But there is a way that we have to be able to take the good and the bad and be truthful about a person. And it doesn't have to take away from who that person was. I think at the heart of it, what we're seeing, especially with these death threats against Gayle King, is an intolerance for challenging really men, but in this particular case, Black men, because the way that people like Snoop Dogg and Boosie and 50 Cent and other folk came after Gayle is really about silencing Black women's ability to ask a question, to hold someone accountable, even if done in love. That's considered disrespectful. And I think that's a problem that we have to contend with in our culture and within our community.
Mark?
It was an interesting moment. I don't think there's anything called a good legacy or a bad legacy. There's a legacy. And part of Kobe's legacy in relationship to what happened in 2003 is who he grew up to become. He was young when that happened, right? We don't know what kind of thinking he had about gender and understanding about what happened that night. And again, this is not to excuse Kobe, but we see someone who has come to terms with that. Even around the WNBA stuff, if you would have asked him 10 years ago about equitable play for women's basketball players, he would not have given the same answer that he gave in 2018, 2019. So part of the conversation we need to have is, how do we get men to grow up? All right, and to mature, to understand where these dynamics are. The irony is that when you look at someone like Snoop Dogg, who is older than Kobe, we have an example of someone who is not grown up in that context. And yes, Gayle King was doing her job and asking a legitimate question, and we might be uncomfortable with that. And individually, we might not have chosen to do that ourselves, but she was not out of bounds for asking those questions. The irony is that this is happening at the same moment where Gayle King's best friend, Oprah Winfrey, for all intents and purposes, has put the kibosh on a film that documents all these Me Too issues around Russell Simmons, right? And it was kiboshed in part because of men like Snoop Dogg and 50 Cent putting pressure on Oprah Winfrey to pull their support away from the Oprah Winfrey film.
Yeah, and Gayle King, to her credit, not only did she do her job when she knew she might come in for some flack just for mentioning it, whether she did or not in advance, she was not going to be silenced afterward. Here she is responding to the backlash.
I know that if I had only seen the clip that you saw, I'd be extremely angry with Me Too. I am mortified, I'm embarrassed, and I am very angry. Unbeknownst to me, my network put up a clip from a very wide-ranging interview, totally taken out of context, and when you see it that way, it's very jarring. It's jarring to me. So I've been told, or I've been advised, to say nothing. Just let it go. People will drag you. People will troll you. It'll be over in a couple of days. But that's not good enough for me.
CBS News anchor Gayle King, in a video she posted on her Instagram feed addressing the social media backlash to her interview with WNBA star Lisa Leslie. Well, let's talk just more generally about Kobe's legacy. Natalie, I'll start with you. I mean, how do you think we will remember him?
Well, I think particularly in light of the girl dad hashtag that was trending in the wake of Kobe's death, I think that's, you know, that's going to be a big part of the way that he's remembered, that he had these four girls, that he was riding hard for his 13-year-old and her potential as a basketball player. I think he'll also be remembered for, and really via his wife, Vanessa, for a relationship that withstood everything that came in the wake of that 2003 case.
I want to turn now to Black History Month. Google created a celebratory ad that debuted during the 2020 Grammys, built from an aggregate of search data to identify Black icons, events, and movements that were most searched within a specific category in the U.S. Let's listen to that clip.
I'll tell you already. But just like life. All right.
Air Jordan, ready to take off.
Can I get an amen? And welcome to the very first National Oprah Winfrey Show!
clip from Google's Black History Month ad, talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, what's your take?
This is the thing. It's not really a Black History Month ad, right? It's a great time to introduce it to folks. But this is the thing. You know, you couldn't do searchable data before 2004. So Google simply did a study of searchable data since 2004 until the summer of 2019. And based on that searchable data, you know, they found different things like the most Googled dunk, Michael Jordan, the most Googled poet, Maya Angelou, the most Googled speech, I Have a Dream, the most Googled social movement, the civil rights movement. And it just turns out that all these things ended up to having to do with African-Americans and African-American life. It is an extraordinary commentary on the increasing curiosity around Black life in ways in which you can't separate it from what America is. Mm. I mean, and because that's really what that is about, that if you search on America, what most often folks will search are Black people.
We're talking about it all today on Back Channel today on The State of Things. So, Natalie, is that an effective ad? Look, America, guess what? If you want to know what America is, the most searched topics end up being African-American life is integrated. I mean, was it a successful message in that way?
I don't know. I mean, I think Mark hit the nail on the head. I'm thinking of a student of mine who, you know, in talking about why is Martin Luther King Day a day off? Like, why do we have a holiday for it? She made the distinction between Black history and American history, and I had to help her understand that Black history is American history. I think that there is a disconnect with much of our mainstream culture in terms of understanding that Black history is and Black culture is not separate and apart from it informs all of our culture, right? And so I think that there is a way that perhaps this Google ad will help, but I also think that unfortunately it's just true. People love Black culture, they don't love Black people. And so even if folks do decide that, oh, okay, I get it, and like it resonates with them, what does that mean? Are we going to now be recognized as worthy of being celebrated all year long? Or, you know, I think we're still going to get February, you know, for Black History Month.
It's leap year this year.
Oh, so we do get extra day. Yes, we do. Thank you.
let's move on. Let's talk about the Sundance Film Festival closed out at the beginning of this month with more diversity and inclusion than any of the other major award shows. Three top directing prizes going to Black women. The directing award for U.S. Dramatic went to Rada Blank, who wrote and made her feature directorial debut, the 40-year-old version. So let's hear a clip of her.
Okay, so the 40-year-old version is about a New York playwright who's down on her luck, who decides that the only way she can salvage her voice is to become a rapper at 40. And, you know, I'm a person who is still very much a part of the culture. I can recite anyone from Kendrick to Scarface, and I feel like as a woman, you know, as women in the culture of hip-hop, we always have to work harder. Mm-hmm. And the industry is always asking you to sell sex. And so I want to show, you know, someone who is influenced by the culture, but not in a way where they want to become famous. They just love the music and love the culture that surrounds the music. And I just, again, I don't think I've seen a story about that mm-hmm. that speaks to people who are my age, who still have something to say where the culture is concerned.
Rada Blank, playwright and filmmaker who won a directing award at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Tell us about Rada, Natalie.
So Rada is apparently someone who has been working behind the scenes for a minute as a playwright. I mean, the film, 40-year-old version, is it's basically autobiographical. But I mean, I just really want to lift up the fact that, you know, we were talking about the Oscars and Sundance. They always seem to get it right when it comes to recognizing and rewarding the work of a diverse array of filmmakers. And so Rada, the other two Black women who won these top awards at Sundance, and Sundance just named a Black woman, well, at least a woman of color, as director of the festival. This all bodes well. I think it speaks to a way that Sundance has its finger on the pulse of what people want to see, and it's also sort of feeding this content into the mainstream. Mark told me right before we began the show that RADA, 40-year-old version, has been picked up by Netflix. Hmm. So everyone will be able to see that. You know, the Oscars...
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, Mark,
no.
What do you think? Sundance getting it right?
I think they are. And they've been getting it right, I think, for 10 years, yeah. Whether we're talking about the scripted films or documentaries.
Yeah.
Many folks have seen them as kind of like the place to go. And clearly now that HBO and Netflix and all these other streaming channels are also going there, I think it creates an opportunity for great moments for Black directors like RADA Blank and others to be able to have kinds of opportunities. I'm sure if you go back and you look at the generation of the Stanley Nelsons or the Spike Lees, of folks like that, that they wish they would have had these kinds of platforms, you know, yeah. existed for them and their ideas 20 years ago.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, it's Back Channel on the State of Things. Speaking of Stanley Nelson, he's just ahead as well. The Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker will join us to talk about the latest two-part project about former NFL quarterback Michael Vick on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Is redemption possible for Michael Vick? That's the question at the center of the new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, Vick. The former Atlanta Falcons star quarterback burst onto the scene in the late 90s and quickly became an athletic and a cultural icon. He was the first Black quarterback ever to be chosen with the number one overall pick in the NFL draft. But his fall from grace was just as steep. He pleaded guilty to charges related to a dogfighting ring run from property he owned and became a national pariah. Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson traces Michael Vick's rise, fall, and road to redemption in a two-part episode streaming now on the ESPN app and ESPN+. Stanley Nelson is with me now. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Great to have you here and still with us, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Actually, I want to start with a clip of this two-part documentary series. Much of the first episode is focused on Michael Vick's upbringing and how his relationship with his family and his community shaped his experience as he went on to the NFL and got famous. Let's listen to this clip.
I wanted to be happy, and I wanted to be around my friends, and, you know, we talked about these moments, you know, playing college football, having the opportunity to go to the pros. We all came up together, and we struggled together, and now somebody's about to make it out. And that was a really good feeling. You know, hard to explain, but you don't get to that point and then just cut people off. I just didn't believe in that.
Former NFL quarterback Michael Vick talking in the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, Vick, from award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson, who is with me right now. Stanley Nelson, tell us more about Newport News and where Michael Vick grew up.
Yeah, Newport News, Virginia, where Michael grew up, is a place that it's kind of like on the way to nowhere. You know, it's you have to be going there to go there. It's a place that was really powered by shipbuilding industry and that kind of collapsed. Michael was born to a teenage mother. He was her second child. And that's where Michael grew up, you know, but he grew up in a community that supported him and that loved him. And for Michael, that was home. And we really wanted to show that in the film. And we looked at Newport News as being a real character in the film.
Yeah, and Newport News is, as well as the family and friends that surrounded him, so you get a real sense of what it was like to be from that place and growing up in that environment. You spent a lot of time with family and friends and got a real picture of what that was like. Tell us, you know, what surprised you about that?
You know, that Mike says, you know, when he gets, he signs to Virginia Tech, you know, that he didn't even want to leave home. You know, his family is sitting around and it's supposed to be a happy day because now he's, you know, signed to go to, you know, a D1 school and be the quarterback. And, you know, they're all sad because it's 5 hours away, a 5 hour drive. And as Mike said, that was the furthest he had ever been from home. And he says, if I had had my way, I would have just stayed in Newport News. And, you know, that's surprising. That's not how we usually think about those communities. You know, a lot of times we think about people wanting to get out and trying to get out. But Mike wanted to stay there, and then he wanted to take that community along with him and, you know, did so for a number of years, you know, took his family and his friends with him.
Yeah, and it was more than a five-hour drive in a lot of ways. I mean, culturally, it was a very different experience for him.
Yeah, as he's very clear about, you know, he's very, you know, open and frank in the film and says, you know, it was the first time he had really been around white people. You know, his coaches were pretty much all white. The student body is largely white. We wanted to give you an idea of what it means, you know, as a black athlete many times on campuses where, you know, the majority of black people on that campus are athletes. And you know, that's all there is.
Not just an athlete, but a black quarterback. And that has been a real source of contention in the American sports world, has it not? And something, you know, even at an institution like Virginia Tech, to sell everybody on the possibility that a black man can actually be the quarterback of the team, not an easy sell back then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, until very recently, there was never a bunch of black quarterbacks, you know, playing in the NFL or in college. You know, there were always one or two. But you know, not very many. As when I was growing up, there were none. Yeah. And so when Mike goes to school, you know, he's one of the first. And you know, it's almost like you're looked at what they call a dual threat quarterback, which means, you know, you're an athletic quarterback. You can run and also throw. But that's almost like a derogatory term. You know, it's not something that's looked on, you know, as an asset. And so many times, black quarterbacks, you know, who had success in college, were moved into being defensive backs or running backs or ends or something like that if they wanted to go to the pros.
And let's listen to another clip from the series that might explain some of that.
The mind is the place where black quarterbacks are always underestimated and always have to prove themselves in a way that their white counterparts do not have to.
So that's why if you listen very closely to an NFL game, if you listen carefully to the commentators, you know, oh, he's so courageous. Oh, he's graced under pressure. Oh, the leadership. And you listen to him, it's really talking about white men. So that position still is a very important cultural position.
I think Michael Vick has athletic ability.
That's a clip from the new two-part ESPN documentary, Vick, from award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson. He's with us, as well as Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark Anthony Neal, that clip, I mean, I think it speaks volumes.
Yeah, I mean, and just a shout out, you know, both Bomani Jones and William C. Roden, you know, who have been representing black sports talk and black sports journalism for so long. You know, at the time that Vic is coming through, you know, Randall Cunningham is still in the league. Warren Moon, who had to go play in Canada first, you know, before he could play in the NFL. So there were examples there. But the thing about Michael Vick, it wasn't just his style of play. It was just his style. When you think about both Michael Vick and Allen Iverson coming out of this Newport News, Virginia Beach area, they're the only two guys in both leagues running around with cornrows, you know, 2000, 2001, 2002. There was something very different. And, you know, and Vic, you know, acknowledges himself in it. He was not as attentive to the playbook because he could improvise, right? And he improvised as long as he physically was allowed to be able to improvise. Once he gets older in the league, he now has to read the playbook. But the league wasn't ready for that. And ironically, the people who loved the Michael Vicks were kids playing video games, right? Because that Michael Vick could do things, right. You know, that John Elway couldn't, that Peyton Manning right. couldn't. And so the league had to come up and catch up to someone who was fundamentally changing the way the sport would play. So that when we talk about Russell Williams, we're talking about Cam Newton right here in North Carolina, you know, none of those players become what they become without Michael Vick. There's a great line he says in the second part where he goes, I think all the times that I was trying to spin out of tackles and do these things, that there were some kids watching me, and it allowed their imagination to think about what they could become.
And Stanley Nelson, that representation is a key part of your two-part series in the documentary. And, you know, Mark mentioned Allen Iverson also coming out of the Tidewater, Virginia, both coming up at the same time. A representation of black life and black cultural representation that even though there were a lot of athletes and they were all doing commercials, these two guys represented something very different in the commercial landscape, right?
Yeah, in many ways, they were the first two athletes, you know, big-time black athletes to say, you know, we're part of this other thing. We're part of, you know, this hip-hop generation, and we're not going to change. You know, this is who we are. You know, the cornrows, the tattoos, the jewelry, that's just who we are. And you know, and we're so good that you have to take us for who we are. Mm-hmm. Iverson was kind of like an idol of Mike Vick's. And, you know, he says outright that, you know, he took Allen's lead and really copied him.
Natalie, I know you're not a huge sports fan, but now, again, as these stories, you know, come to you and you see them unfold, I mean, what's your take on all this?
I mean, I thought I was riveted watching Vick because I remember when, you know, the infamy came about, and I remember, even though I was not a big sports fan, I was not particularly politically conscious. I knew that that was not right. You know, I knew that what the way that Vick was being treated because of the dog fighting, that it had racist overtones. But I'd like to ask Stanley a question, which is, you know, Stanley, do you think that this unapologetic way that Michael Vick and Allen Iverson sort of presented themselves, and, you know, this cockiness had something to do with the way that the federal government seemed to be determined to prosecute him over something that the local officials were willing to pass up?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, that's one of those things, you know, where you ask a black person and you know, there's two minds. You know, there's no proof that the federal government was after him because of his cockiness. But, you know, as a black man in America, you know, I would say, of course, that was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was part of why many of the fans were so vitriolic in their turning on Mike Vick. It was. You know, it was all one thing. And I think it's part of this whole of who Mike was. You know, he's a hero, and then all of a sudden everything turns on him so drastically. So I think, if you ask me, it was.
Well, and you do obviously treat the dog fighting story and the criminal part of this. But I wonder about your approach to probing the case and how your exploration of that was received by him and by his family and friends.
You know, Mike was very honest about it. I mean, you know, he's talked about it before, and, you know, he was great in his honesty about it. He was very helpful, I think, in his family and his friends who were involved in the dogfighting scandal with him, you know, called him up on the phone and, you know, right before the interview, and were like, Mike, should we do this? And he said, yeah, you should go ahead and do it. You know, I'm talking to them and I believe in them. So he was very helpful in that, and I think very, very honest. In many ways, you know, Mike's hope for redemption is honesty, mm-hmm. and say, you know, this is what happened. I'm sorry. You know, what I did was wrong, but I'm not going to hide from any of it because it's all out there.
Well, here he is talking a little bit about just that.
I spent enough time out there. Yeah, I spent enough time out there to know what was going on, and you know, enough time out there where I could always put a stop to it. But I was really, really competitive, and I loved dogs. And somehow, some way, that got intertwined and never got away from it, never walked away from it. I looked at it as, this is my deal. This is what I do outside of football. You know, and of course, I wish it was golf. I wish I would have took those golf clubs that Dan Reeves gave me and put them to use.
Former quarterback Michael Vick on ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary, Vick, from Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson, who is here. Stanley, you spoke with Roger Goodell for the series. Talk about your interviews and what that showed you about Goodell and the way the NFL as a corporation was approaching this.
You know, I really admired Goodell's treatment of Mike in many, many ways, you know. Well, one is a brave thing to say, you know, we're going to have to suspend you for this time. But to let him back and say, you know, open the door for him coming back, because there was no guarantee when Mike got out of jail that he would ever come back. The NFL had suspended him. You know, he was not on the Atlanta Falcons anymore. But to say, Roger Goodell and the NFL to say, we will open the door. We'll end our suspension if there will be a team to take him. So I think that was really admirable. And I also think that, you know, with just what recently happened with the Pro Bowl, where Mike was made an honorary captain, and there were thousands and thousands of signatures gathered to say, you know, that shouldn't happen. Roger Goodell and the NFL said, no, he has done everything he can do to redeem himself, and we are going to stand by our decision to have Mike Vick be one of the honorary captains. I think that was, you know, a brave and honorable thing to do.
Talking to Stanley Nelson today on The State of Things, along with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, what about this? We talked about redemption in the last segment, too, with regard to Kobe, you know, legacies that are allowed to extend long enough to allow somebody to mature and grow into adulthood.
You know, I was always struck in the film when he dealt with his bankruptcy and the fact that he had a way out without paying all of his debts, and he chose to go the other way against, you know, the protests of his wife, among other folks. What you see is someone who recognized his mistakes and was very stand up about it. You know, when he talked about his relationship with his friend later in the series, you know, this is the thing. And we give men like Iverson and even LeBron James and Michael Vick a lot of credit for recognizing the people who protected them and who allowed them to thrive when they were younger. They take care of these folks. But there comes a point where you just have to make a decision. And I'm sure there's a part of Michael Vick who's saying, I wish I would have had the capacity to make that decision. You know, I'll buy y'all all of your own houses that you can mess up, but I need to keep y'all away from my family, right? And what's my space? Because ultimately, I'm the person who's going to lose the most within the context of this. And so you see someone who, yes, there's some redemption, but you also see someone who's just profoundly sad for squandering away the kinds of opportunities that he had, even as he's able to rebuild his reputation and have a, you know, regular presence on Sunday morning television talking about football and what have you.
Listen, there's a way that Michael Vick's experience, particularly with this relationship with his old friends, and the fact that at some point he has to let them go. It's mirrored in, you know, some of the students that I had when I taught at a HBCU, and quite likely that I teach at NC State. But there is this reticence, there's this guilt almost of making it out, quote unquote, and wanting to bring your homeboys with you, wanting to bring the community with you, and really struggling to straddle the line between, you know, moving forward, progressing, going to college, moving out, you know, and all of that, and then staying true to where you came from, being loyal to these people who, you know, stood by you as you were growing. And I think that's one of the things that I find really poignant about Michael Vick's story, because that loyalty, you know, he didn't let go soon enough.
Stanley Nelson, are there other athletes, other public figures who you think, who you're now interested in, who have similar stories?
I don't know. You know, we literally just finished this film about a week and a half ago.
Wow.
You know, so you know, I
y'all work
I love
like rappers.
I would love to do more. You know, we also have a film about Miles Davis that's coming on PBS on February
20th. Which we've all seen
20th.
And love.
Yeah, so it's finally hitting the air after a year. So it's time to sit back and think about stuff.
Stanley Nelson, Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, directed the new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary on Michael Vick, currently available on ESPN app and ESPN Plus. Stanley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also with us, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Thank both of you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.